go ahead and get started. Welcome everybody to day three of the water discussions. And I think it's interesting. I love following Ron because Ron's having this really interesting discussion this week just about how are we relating to the land and how we relate to issues like water spiritually and really asking some of those questions. So I'm technically the biologist kind of guy, so I'm going to get more into some of these issues of water resources and just a little bit of background on me. I grew up in Missouri and as a Methodist, and they still let me come to Holden, which is great. Grew up around farming, a bit playing in the creeks and whatnot. And one of the things I learned from being a place like that is that some of the best conservationists out there are farmers. Because the people who weren't don't have farms anymore. They work in the Everett factory. So the idea of people who live on the land being stewards of the land was just ingrained into my thinking. And so I went off to school in Colorado and started studying biology and environmental science, and I was quickly aware of this conflict that had emerged between producers like farmers and land users and sort of environmentalists, and it never made any sense to me because I saw so much common ground between these two people, and what you see in what I kept seeing in real life was all these conflicts. So that really led me to do a lot of things that I've done professionally and just from an academic standpoint. So I got really interested in how communities work and how values work. So I did my graduate work in social ecology that was really designed to look at how do human communities and natural communities interact. I did my graduate research on carnivore conflicts in the Yellowstone area, which was pretty interesting. And went straight from that into water in the West. And I can't figure out which one of those has more conflict involved, but there's quite a get to bit with both of them. So that is kind of gets us up to this point. That's actually my son about 4 years ago. And I was going to give Ron this picture of taking the apple from the tree. You know? I thought that was pretty good. Water does mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And certainly when we learn about water in school, you know, we're thinking about the water cycle and everything. What I'm gonna do in this talk, and like I've done this whole week, is put humans into the equation and into the pool and see how these human systems and how our culture interacts with water, in addition to other natural resources, how that's going and how maybe we can work to make it go a little better. So this is kind of what I talked about yesterday. And I would say that in a lot of places where water is scarce and over-allocated in the West, this picture is a thousand words. Water is a contested resource. Obviously not only amongst fish, tribes, environmentalists, and farmers, but amongst farmers themselves. There isn't enough water in any of these streams. And I think this is from a postcard that I stole, and I forgot to reference it, so I get a little black mark against me. This whole is really, they tell us we need to really reference our copyrights, and I didn't do it with this slide. But I think this is called something like water collaboration in the West or something. So yesterday what we talked about is when people, a lot of it is how we define problems. A lot of how we solve problems relates to how we define problems in the first place. And like water, like in a lot of things, tends to go like this. Now, how many of you, and apologies if you were here yesterday, are pastors or people who have counseled married couples who are having problems? How many of you have done this? Okay. Now, when you hear somebody say something like this, my problem in my relationship is, or even when you've done this in your own relationships, when somebody's saying this, How do you think the discussion's going to go? Is it going to go well or is it going to go badly?
Pretty badly.
And we have a tendency when there's a problem to look at everybody else and what they're doing to us. You know, we victimize ourselves within that. And, you know, you look at a lot of our political conflicts that we have right now in our country. Water is just a perfect example of why, you know, you can start to look at some of the problems and where they start with the water definition. So this is some things. I work for an organization called Washington Water Trust. My job is to go and kind of play let's make a deal with irrigators around eastern Washington and figure out a way to get water and stream for salmon. So I talk to tribes, I talk to farmers, I talk to environmental groups, municipalities. These are some of the things I hear when I'm out there. Socialist government agencies stealing water, elitist environmentalists, greedy farmers and developers, entitled Indians. You know, these are how people define our water problem. So how's this going to work out? Well, we know how it's working out. And really we're seeing, okay, why do we have a conflict? Well, this is how we're defining the problem. And we're defining the problem in a way that's dooming us to not get along with each other. So this is something I'm kind of playing with this week, and I'm trying to find ways of talking about the sources of conflict from a spiritual perspective. And, you know, I've done a lot of thinking about it, and I think that it comes down to two things. And one of them is we really do define our well-being separately from the well-being of our neighbors. And the second thing is that we are separating ourselves from nature, in which I'm, you know, I think that God is, and nature are very connected. And it makes me think of Jesus' two commandments. His first two commandments are to love God with all of your heart and love your and all of your mind. When we are, if you think about the way we're treating creation right now, in some ways we're not doing so well in the first commandment. You know, when you look at the environmental degradation that's happening, in some ways we are destroying parts of God. The same thing, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, loving our neighbor as ourselves. One of the things that I really want to get across is that the only way we're going to get through conflicts, whether it's water or anything, is if we learn to understand and even take on the values of the other people who share that resource with us, or share that space with us, whether it's, you know, a watershed or a church, you know, or a household or a community. How our values interact in those confined places, like a water source, dictate how we get along and allocate those resources within that. So this is sort of, if you guys want to, somebody asked for a copy of this, so if you want it, you can have it. When I went to graduate school, I was really looking for ways to take, okay, the water cycle and the ecosystem science and all this stuff, and ask, how do humans interact with that? How can we start being realistic about the fact that it's not just, you know, it's not like this human community is some, you know, is some colony from another planet that just lives here and gets all of our stuff from some other planet, you know? We're so not separate from nature. And yet, if you look at ecosystem science, the role of people within that is entirely left out. And if you look at social science and political science, the resources of the natural world and environment are commodities, are sources of capital, but are entirely left out. When in actuality, we're sort of in the same place together. That's not a value statement, that's the truth. So if this middle piece here, which I'm calling, this is a model, and it's a systems model, just like an ecosystem model, but it's based on something called the human ecosystem framework, which is designed to look at an ecosystem, but to really include humans in that system and the way that we operate on those systems. The middle part, resources, are basically the ecosystem, you know, the natural world. And, you know, when we look at the issue of water, I'm looking at, when I'm thinking about managing water, what are the resources, what are the physical things around water that impact my ability to manage it and distribute it in different ways? Fish and wildlife, our resources depends on water, but they also become a justification for having water. Land is really important, how we take care of the riparian areas and the lands around the water dictate how much is available at different times of the year. Money, which is financial capital, is an important resource to, you know, figure out how to, if we got to build projects or we got to get water rights at different times of the year or you know, any of those things. You know, money impacts a lot of what we're able to do and how we're able to allocate water. And if anybody doesn't believe me, just go to California and look what they're building there. Social capital. Has anyone heard this term before, social capital? There's a great book that has a little bit to do with the environmental issues, but it's called Bowling Alone. And it's talking about how we've lost community in the United States. How the idea is the guy goes out and there's this bowling alley and there's this guy bowling all by himself. And he's like, who bowls by himself? You know, that's not what bowling's all about. We used to have these bowling leagues and we'd have churches and we'd have bridge groups and all this stuff. And now everybody's, you know, I mean, I've got 350 Facebook friends. I mean, I really do.
Yeah.
and I like go home and turn my Facebook. Like, I got all this Facebook stuff to do. And, you know, that's how our world is changing. We're actually losing social capital. And as there was an interesting discussion in the last session about how that face-to-face contact with each other not only builds a sense of responsibility for each other, but also builds social capital. You know, if I was to stand up at Vespers tonight and say, hey, I'm having a party at my house, and then Chuck was to stand up the next right after me and say, hey, I'm having a party at my house, I'm thinking more people go to Chuck's party because he has more social capital at Holden than I do. So the idea is it's about our influence with each other, our ability to gather those resources and people together. I spent a lot of time talking about that because I think it's a really important resource. It's really that resource of community. So humans interact on each side of that. Our values interact on these resources, like water. And values, some examples of values include our cultural identity. You know, I work with a lot of farmers, and purely this idea of we're going to want to keep agriculture alive in our county because it's a part of who we are. We want to have, and you talk to other people, it's like we want to have fish in our rivers and have recreation opportunities for fishing or rafting or kayaking in our rivers because that's part of who we are. You know, there's an identity of people, this is who I am, and as well as economic interests. How we use water creates jobs. It creates tax base for county governments and local governments. It feeds people, you know. And conservation values as well. So the idea is we're really looking at all the values around water and, you know, just identifying what those are. Institutions is really just a fancy way of talking about people and the social structures that operate on the resource. So these institutions are stakeholders, you know, different agencies, conservation groups, ag groups, local governments, churches, and they are the sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? They kind of distribute the resources according to the values and represent how those resources represent the values and really do the work to distribute the resources according to the values of whatever that catchment area is, you know, and so the way they manage water in some places is different than in other places based on what those local values are, how they work together. So yesterday we were talking about why do we have water conflicts. I was talking about, first of all, we have a problem definition where we're defining the problem according to essentially scarcity, and we're defining the problem according to this idea that I have something that everybody else is kind of trying to take away from me. And we're engaging in this conflict between that. And so there's conflicts amongst the values with people wanting different things for a shared resource. And those are real conflicts. And we have to work through those. There's something else that are what I call symbolic conflicts. Now, when I was growing up, I used to call these the ice tray arguments that my parents would have. They would get into this big fight over the ice trays. My mom's like, you know, you fill up the ice trays and you put it in the, you empty it into the bucket and then you fill them up so you always have ice. And my dad was like, oh, you just take a couple out at a time and it's empty. You know, and I remember this 1 hour argument that they had about ice trays. Now, was this argument about ice trays?
No.
No. Who here has had an ice tray argument with a loved one? Okay, that's a symbolic conflict. We're projecting something else into it, either because we have this agenda or because we're really afraid to talk about what the real conflict is. So when we think about our values and how our values are interacting into a system, we're looking at moving and divorcing ourselves from the symbolic conflicts, talking about the real conflicts, and building trust around shared values. You know, we're looking for something called the common interest. And I'll define that a little bit more as we go along. But the common interest essentially is everybody's values together. It may not all be my values or all your values, but it's like, okay, all these things are important in our community. That's our common interest. And you look for win-win solutions out of that. Resources. When you have problems in a resource issue or any problem, you have issues of scarcity or degradation. I always think of resources as the proverbial pie. You know, the pie is too small. The other problem that happens is there's poor access to the resource. Well, why is that important? It's important because people who don't have access to a resource that they need go about getting it in other ways, which are very inefficient. You know, either through stealing or through litigation or through threats, through violence. So when people don't have access to a reasonable share or a fair process of getting access to some of these shared resources and they're a stakeholder, it's bad for everybody. So when we move into the green area, notice my subliminal psychological manipulation here. Red, green. We're expanding resources, bigging the pie. That's why we want like to do conservation. Whenever you conserve things, it means that if there's a contested or shared resource, there's going to be more for somebody else. And equalizing access to the resource through shared agreements. Institutions. I think about this idea of narrow agendas versus mutual agendas. You know, a narrow agenda is, you know, I just want this. You know, this is the solution I want. This is what I want. You know, a mutual agenda is about expanding that to say, okay, I'm going to work for what you want too, just like you're going to work for what I want. Collective problem solving versus, you know, this is a conflict resolution workshop in and of itself, but I think most of you know kind of the kind of main concepts of conflict resolution and what tends to promote more conflict and how to move beyond that. But that's a skill. Collective problem solving is a skill. Having good access to information. Sometimes people don't trust each other because there's different sources of information and nobody knows what to believe or there's not enough information. So if you can have more information and people can agree on what the information is, then they can actually make decisions together. And good leadership and facilitation. So I talk about this because this is a very realistic way of understanding ourselves, of defining a problem according to people and values and what you want, what your goal is. You could apply this to anything, and I think we're going to tomorrow, and not necessarily just the water world. So this is how I would define the problem with water. Existing water resources are not being optimally allocated to serve our shared values or mutual interests. If you look at these, can any of you tell me which one of these you don't support?
Well,
Is there one of these that any of you knows of support? Does anybody here just want to kill off the wildlife? Does anybody here want farmers to go out of business? Does anybody here think that it should just look ugly out here instead of nice? Or that people should not have economic opportunity? That somebody else's cultural identity, if it's attached to, you know, mining or logging or farming or rafting or fishing, is unimportant? You know, that our kids don't matter? These are shared values. We all agree on this stuff. And with that becomes shared responsibility. Sounds a little bit like Holden Village. This community works along this model. Everybody comes from different places. Everybody has different expectations, different needs. You know, I went on this big long hike today, and other people were working on the trail, and other people were weaving or working in the kitchen. And that's why this community works, is there we work together to create these opportunities for everybody. We value each other even when we're different. And you know, one of the, I think, from talking to people, the conversations that always happens the Holden Village is, how do we take this out there? How do we continue this feeling, whatever it is that happens here, whether it's spiritual renewal or community, and how do we move it into the outside world? So I think a lot of it is understanding why it works, and I think it's that shared responsibility for each other and each other's values. So when we think about water, the problem helps us define a solution. And we're working from shared values. And the first thing we're doing is defining all the stakeholders. Everybody who has a stake in the water, they all get access. They all matter. We learn about each other's values, focusing on shared interest. I forgot the bullet, but do stuff. You know, I don't know how many things you guys have been involved in where you have 5 years of strategic planning and then nobody does anything. You know, and it's like, I'm not going to any more meetings. I know I've done this. I'm not going to one more of those stupid meetings because all they sit do is sit and talk about stuff. We got to do stuff, even if it's this little thing. You know, build trust and say, okay, we did something and it worked, so maybe we can try something else. Resolve the real conflicts and dismiss the symbolic ones. Make participation voluntary. You know, this is an important one. If somebody's going to be a part of a project, they need to have the freedom to say, I'm not comfortable. It might take longer, and it might take some more communication. But once you get to the point of forcing people into the discussion, you know, you've already lost the battle. And this is my favorite. You become fierce advocates. You know, somebody with a little bullhorn up here, you know, with a sign for the common interest. Not for my interest, not for your interest, but you're out there protesting in the streets for the common interest. You know, that's what we need to be fighting for. We're really good at fighting for our interests, but I think that's really important. So that's when we talk about solving the Western water problem. We have this common interest of providing water for this coexisting value. In my work, we think about fish and farms. And in a nutshell, when they built the dams, the hydroelectric dams in the Pacific Northwest, they basically eliminated a whole bunch of salmon runs. And there were two issues at play. One was the Endangered Species Act, which was passed in 1973. But a more important one, and a more powerful one here, are the tribal treaties that we have with groups like the Yakimas and the Umatillas and the Colvilles, who actually have fishing rights. So the interesting thing is that in order to keep relicensing these dams, which, by the way, give our region the cheapest power in the world, we have the cheapest power in the world here. You know, you wonder why Facebook and Google, all these people they're building these data farms out in Washington along the Columbia power grid, because it's the cheapest place to get power. But in order to keep relicensing the dams, they have to mitigate for the salmon. So we have these challenges with, okay, we got to put salmon in these streams that are over-allocated. You know, we have these values that are changing. We have agriculture that still needs to exist. I love this picture of the salmon crossing the road. But at the same time, is there opportunities where funding for salmon recovery, I mean, we're able to take funding from these salmon recovery mitigation requirements that the hydro folks have and basically create these solutions for the agricultural community that keeps them whole. And I'm gonna talk about ways that works. But the nice thing that about water is that it's very flexible. And you know, there's a lot of things you can do with water. It's really a good application for this framework because you can really expand the pie really quickly with water. Is anybody here familiar with how water rights work, or not familiar? In the East, you have something called the riparian doctrine, which basically means that if you live next to the stream, you can take water, and if you don't, you can't, and you just can't pollute it for the downhill people. We have a little bit different system here, but where you actually have a quantity and you can move water from the source, but it's very specific about what you can do with it. But really, you have a point of diversion that you can put it out of the ditch, you can consume it with some sort of crop or hydropower or whatever, and some of it gets evaporated and some of it goes back into the stream. So we talk about diversions and how we talk about consumptive use and non-consumptive use. But at the end of the day, if somebody has a water right, it's that they have this ability to have a footprint on the stream of taking water out. And in over-allocated streams, you have so many of these competing uses that the stream runs out. And there's nothing for anybody, including fish. So our organization works with this idea of water rights. It's an ownership-based system, a privatized system, which we talked about yesterday. But we have these are property rights, this certificate that can use the water. It's intentionally blurry because, this is one of my clients, but they probably don't care. But some of them are very old. I've worked with water rights that are from the 1870s. So what we've done in Washington State, let me see, make sure I got this. I'm not sure what's going on there. We've identified areas where water is critical. And so this is a map of Washington. And I'm trying to find us. I think that might be like...
On the 47.
47? Yeah. So this isn't a fish critical basin. And you probably figured that out when you took the boat up here. two issues. I mean, one is a passage issue in Lake Chelan, but two is there's a lot of water here. But a lot of places we work around the state in the yellow, these are areas where the fish, we said, hey, if we do some, let's make a deal with the farmers, we can get fish back in some of these streams. And so we just basically work with Washington water law. I won't go into too much detail on that, but the idea is that we're trying to acquire good water rights. Yeah.
Could you go back to the map and what do you mean by critical water areas? Where you mean there's not enough, or the fish are in danger?
Yeah, these are areas
Nooksack,
where
there's not enough water. I grew up there. It rained every minute of the day.
Where are you at?
I was on the Nooksack River.
On the Nooksack River, there are areas where water has been over-allocated now in certain tributaries of that river to where salmon aren't getting up to places where they were before, just because of the amount of development that's happened in those areas.
Really?
Well, people want their lawns in August and September, and it does stop raining then. And that's...
We never watered. I mean, it was rain the whole time.
Well, people like their lawns. Year round. Yeah, I like that. I mean, you know, it's surprising because it's like right now the last thing Seattle people want is more water, you know, but the lawns do dry out. People water their lawns in Seattle. It's amazing. But there are places, over in that area where that happens. So we work with just water laws for what they are. And what we've done in the state of Washington that's really great is in a water right, basically you have to use it or you lose the water right. So you have to have a beneficial use. It was designed originally to promote economic growth during the pioneer days, so that people couldn't hoard a bunch of water because they needed as many people growing orchards and mining and grazing as possible so that, you know, so that they could make money off the West and colonize and encourage people to come out. So if you take 5 years and don't use it, you lose it. But the beneficial uses didn't include putting water in stream for the fish. So they created a mechanism where we could actually help work with an irrigator to acquire some part of a water right and protect it in the stream for the salmon. And that's, we work with something called Trust Water, which is great because we can then kind of have something to acquire and, you know, it does commodity, if water is a commodity in our culture, you know, as an organization, we're not going to be able to change that anytime soon. So we work with what we have with that. And we work with farmers to develop these different types of, it's a water market. If any of you are familiar with these ideas of cap and trade systems or wetlands mitigation systems, it's a similar concept where we're looking at water rights as, in terms of a water market and trying to acquire things using economic systems to do that. So we go and talk to farmers and we'll lease or purchase or have donations of water rights in the stream, and we provide them with the ability to continue to maintain a beneficial use of their water, but also gain some, because their value, you know, is to maintain their farms, to maintain economic viability of their farms. It's a complete waste of time for me to say, well, I'm an environmentalist, and those farmers, you know, they're just trying to make a bunch of money and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's one of these red areas of conflict. Doesn't help us solve the problem, you know. And they might sit there and say, well, I don't want to help those environmentalists or help those fish because they're just from Seattle, and they're probably coming drinking lattes, you know, and unfortunately those guys don't get to work with us because they don't want to. Because they project this idea to us. But the people who do work with us, I think, do really well. But we go through this whole process of identifying the values and et cetera. The whole thing I talk about, there's a lot of, I'm going to skip through some of this to get to the case studies. But we really focus on this idea of flexibility and balance, which basically means that we're asking a farmer what they want, what their management plan, what their business plan on their farm looks like, and we're looking for ways, basically, to work at the margins of that, where they may not be making money as much money at some part of it, and it happens to be water that they're using on their farms during a time of the year when we need it, and we're looking to get that water. So, here's one example. Tatum Creek is in the Yakima Basin, which is just about, I don't know, about 2 hours south of here, by where I live. I live in Yakima, I'm in the Yakima Basin. But this is a situation where you had an irrigation district that was diverting most of the stream for most of the winter out of the streams, basically so people could have keep their livestock operations going. It was a summer and winter diversion, but they diverted the whole creek. So, you know, you think about how salmon run. You know, if you divert the whole creek, what's going to happen when they get to the town of the creek? They didn't know where to go. So everything, not only everything that got the water doesn't get salmon, but everything above what got the water doesn't get salmon either. Well, this was really easy. We just said, okay, we worked at the college, and we gave them, each of them said, here's enough money to put in a well and pump it as long as you need it. And we sort of said, you can decide to put in a well, or you can decide to go to Hawaii. It's kind of up to you. But that we gained an agreement with the people in this district to switch over to wells. And then we restored pretty much a whole stream for the winter time. We're working on the summer now. and we're able to restore one of the critical seasons during salmon spawning and migration up the river just with this one agreement. So here's a good example. We didn't take anything away from people. They could still get water for the cows and the in the winter time but we got water back in the stream. They probably made a little bit of money out of the deal, which is fine. And then the Bonneville Power Administration, which runs the dams, who helped fund the project, gets to put some little mitigation beams in their bucket. And so then they keep relicensing the dams, and everybody gets cheap power, more fish, everybody farms, more power, everybody's happy. So these are the types of things we're looking at. And I can tell that people are thinking, well, those dams, Bonneville, being able to keep those dams in business, we don't want that. Symbolic conflict. that's not about the issue. That's an issue about dams. And certainly issues about river ecosystems and some business, it's an important debate to have, but it's not this debate. You need to have that debate somewhere else. We're trying to get fish back in these streams. We're trying to get flows restored in these tributaries. This achieves that. So, tough if people don't like some part of it, some farmer next door, the guy's like, why are they doing that for the fish? They're just helping out those environmentalists or whatever. These are all voluntary agreements. So this is what I mean about being an advocate for the common interest. And I'm a big advocate for this. I think that everybody who actually is a stakeholder in this stream and this issue won.
Is it the power companies that are the primary funders of making this happen?
It's the Bonneville Power Administration, which is a government, quasi-government agency. And they are their own beast. I don't even know how to describe them. Like, maybe a little bit like the Bureau of Reclamation, but with they're in charge of the Columbia power grid. So all the big, think about all the big hydroelectric dams that are here in the Pacific Northwest. They're the ones who run all of those. They put those projects in at the same scale as the Army Corps put those big projects in on the upper Missouri, big behemoth-like projects. I mean, I think of those things like the Roadrunner and the Coyote, when the animal falls on its head, It's just like these big agencies just come in and do stuff. That's the world we live in, and we're just working I'm not going to get into the debate about whether the Army Corps should exist or not, or if they messed up or didn't mess up. I'm just concerned about places like the Tianaway, which is in my backyard. I take my kids camping here, and it's beautiful. And there's a lot of hay farmers in the Tianaway. And here's one of our staff people with some of the farmers, some of the people that we've worked with there. So basically, we have all these, it's more than 19 now, but this is my favorite example, the late season hay lease. So if you're familiar with how hay gets cut, you'll cut hay 3 or 4 times a year. If you're in a place where you have to irrigate, you're irrigating all year. Well, the third or the fourth hay cutting is, for lack of a better word, crap. It's like, it's good, it's okay, but you're not really making a whole lot of money off of it. You're getting about 75% of your production in the early part of the year. And that has to do with the amount of heat days and what the local hay varieties like to grow in. Corn's different. Corn likes hot days. Hay doesn't. Well, when we're looking at when the streams are drying out for the salmon, it's August and September. When they're looking at when the hay is worth the least, it's August and September. So we have a shared value. We have an opportunity to help each other out. They want to be able to continue to make money off of their farming operation. And some of these guys irrigating, you guys know farmers? It's like being in church. Most people are, 60% of them are over 65. And they're out there in August. They pray to God every day to figure out a way to not have to irrigate in August, I guarantee you. Because it's hard work to get out there irrigating every day. And maybe they can go and take vacation in August and see the grandkids or do something. They know they're making money, and they know that the only reason they watered in the first place is the use it or lose it thing. They were worried that they were going to lose their water right if they didn't use it throughout the season. So we give them a beneficial use. They make as much or more money off of us as they would have off of farming. We get the fish back in the stream. The Tianaway, based on the projects that we've done, is Well, when the biologists looked at this river system, they said, okay, we need to keep 12 CFS of water going down this river year-round to maintain the salmon populations at the target levels. When we started working on this river about 10 or 12 years ago, it was probably around 2, and right now it's around 10, and we're about to close a permanent deal with people that's going to get it up close to 12. So because of these voluntary agreements, a stream that didn't have any salmon, that was basically had dead salmon in there year-round, or in the late summer, is able to restore its function for salmon because of these types of projects. And so again,
I've got a question for you. What would it take to get salmon back at Railroad Creek?
Helicopters?
Is steep ladders.
I mean, is there some feasible
There are some places, and I don't know enough about Railroad Creek, but especially in glacial areas, glacials tend to create these hanging valleys, and they're natural barriers. Salmon can't. There's parts of Washington where salmon never were there. I don't know if they were ever in Railroad Creek.
I don't think they were ever in Railroad Creek. Were they ever in Lake Chelan?
Yeah, I don't.
Because Chelan Falls, that's where Chelan has its hydrant. I don't think there's something that got up there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So it might be a natural barrier.
Hey, the immigrant salmon. Yeah.
There are kokanee that spawn in the mouth of river.
Oh, there's kokanees?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know much about the system. It's not a water quantity issue here. I mean, I'm guessing is that there's flows in here in September every year, or flows around in the creek. So it's why it's not a yellow forest. But this is another one I like. Okanagan County, you've heard of the private property rights folks, you know, this is like ground zero for private property rights folks. These people hate city dwellers, they hate barn dwellers, they're suspicious of anybody from the outside, and for good reason. They're really far away, they're way up in the northern part of the state, and nobody ever comes there and pays attention to them. And whenever there's a vote about something, Okanagan County loses because they don't have the representation. It's a classic rural urban thing. In addition, we have the tribe, the Colville tribe, right next to the people, and they've been fighting for years. So the people hate the tribe, and the tribe hates the people. And then, this is just a place where, I remember the first time I showed up there to talk to the Okanagan Irrigation District, and I'm sitting there, and the guy's like, hey, how's it going, you know? And I'm sitting there talking, and this one guy, he just like, I saw him turn redder and redder. I was really worried about him. But he was just like glaring at me. I mean, nobody said it. They were like looking at their watches. And, you know, trust was a big issue. We had a long ways to go. And they really felt like they'd been lied to and they didn't know who to trust. So at this irrigation district was off of Salmon Creek, which is really funny. Well, Salmon Creek hadn't had salmon in it since before 1900. Because the Bureau had built this big lake and this big diversion structure, and they just diverted, there was one water right on the whole creek, and it was Okanagan Irrigation District, diverted the whole creek. Well, meanwhile, the tribe and the district are just, you know, suing each other. Millions of dollars are being spent. No thing's getting anywhere. This is a really expensive thing. And the district is looking at this situation where they might actually be forced by the government to do things. I'm sure that the negotiations about, you know, the stuff for the tailings can, you know, at some point people said, well, we can't afford to fight this anymore. The cost of fighting it is, you know, not worth what we're going to get out of it. So anyway, we were able to kind of work through that and do some voluntary agreements. Serve as an intermediary between the tribes and the district to get them to release water during the time of the year when the fish were getting up above their diversion, because there's that area above the diversion which is really valuable for salmon. Meanwhile, the tribe went in and made a low flow channel so that they didn't have to, you know, release as much water off of there. And they were able to actually get the water simply with the number of people that had sort of gone out of the service area because of shifting agricultural practices. They had the water available. We worked to get the funding set up. I mean, we don't have money. We can get other people's money and spend it on these projects. But right now, this creek is fully restored. There's about 1,200 to 1,700 acre feet going down the river based on a voluntary agreement with the irrigation district. Nobody who was farming apples or pears or anything like that before the agreement is not farming them now. And because of this one project, the steelhead, which is a quasi-salmon, in the Okanagan River, is projected to increase by about 30 to 50% just because of how much habitat's in this one thing. So we really do look for projects that don't hurt agriculture. And the only reason we're able to do this is because people learn that about us. They're like, okay, these guys are on the level. They're kind of like the white hats. You know, they're not going to sell us down the river. But it takes a while to build the trust to do that. But it's definitely possible. We work all over the state. I'm going to skip through a lot of this stuff. Exempt wells are an issue we're dealing with where I live. This is a good example on symbolic conflicts that happen. But we really think about economics. We think about water. We're developing this idea of water banks where, you know, you can kind of collect and reallocate water according to growing needs and changing needs of populations. Again, we're doing this throughout the state. We have water exchanges, we have water banks. This is the Dungeness one. I'm obviously ran out of time. Now you wonder, you know, these professor types, they come up to Holden and they're up there in their lodges or cafeteria, like, what are they doing, you know? Well, they do stuff like this. Just so you know, this is what college professors do when they have too much time on their hands. But
we make charts.
My father was a college professor, so I feel entitled to make fun of them. I don't know why. But anyway, this is a model. It's a water bank, and all the things I've been talking about before about values and allocating according to shared values are represented in this, about human values and institutions working together around the resources to widen the pie, to focus on shared values. So we're basically acquiring water rights from willing sellers. We're putting them to this bank. And what's happening in the Dungeness, for example, in this part, the river was closed to any new water appropriation. So let's say you're sitting there at the county commission meeting, and you're a commissioner, and this great opportunity for a business or a development comes up that's going to increase the tax base by however many million dollars a year. It's like, great, looks good, it's in a good spot. Oh, there's no water. Sorry, you can't do it. You're behind the eight ball. Everybody's losing. So at the same time, we're like, okay, well, if we can kind of develop a mechanism of reallocating so that there is a possibility for economic growth to continue. We want water in the stream. That's our condition. Let's do something. So we pull the funds together. We get everybody together. And we put these flow agreements to get water into the public resource pool. And we allocate it. We know that we need to get X amount for restoration and river flows. We know new groundwater uses are going to be important for economic development. This bank reallocates water according to the changing values of the community and allows us to keep water in the stream. We're always changing. You know, I think the problem that we have in a lot of cases is that we always get stuck in the past and we're not adapting to new needs and new requirements. You know, it's not like there isn't enough water. You know, there's an abundance of water. What's scarce and what makes water scarce is how we interact around the problem, not the water itself. And I think this is why, you know, going back to, and this is what I think about environmental sustainability. I purely believe that environmental sustainability needs to keep people working. It needs to keep economies flowing just like it keeps rivers flowing. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Because you have somebody that does not have access to their values. If we're shutting people out, and you know, I mean, I work really hard for private property rights-based values in these communities I work for, but you know, the way I vote would make most Democrats wonder if I was a socialist. But it doesn't matter, you know. my personal agenda and, you know, my personal values, I mean, I'm not going to apologize about them or say that I don't deserve to have them. But when I want to solve problems, I'm going to pay attention to what yours are, too, and work for those as well. You know, that's why I don't get shot in the Okanagan.
There's a good reason.
So... but what I want to do tomorrow actually is, what we're going to do tomorrow is I'm going to talk a little bit about the future of water and some of the, don't mind that, I'm just trying to go back to my little chart that you guys have, but looking at that chart, people can choose something, but I'm actually going to walk through the process of applying a model or a systems model like this to a, to any problem. Actually, I'm not even going to require that you use water or even an environmental problem. Wow, that was a lot of slides. Way too many slides.
I think you're going backwards.
I am. I'm trying to get backwards. Oh, wait. I know I'm going forward. Oh, never mind. Here, there's probably here. So, anyway, using this chart, you can. I won't make you share unless you don't want to. But you can use this in personal relationships. If you're having trouble with somebody in your family or your at work or whatever, this works. If you're working on stuff with your church, my church was 3 years ago was on the verge of death because you know we had attendance drops or whatever and we had to change. Well, we didn't do this, but we did something like this, and it applies to that. If you're in some community where there's some conflict or problem that you're trying to work through. So whatever it is, you know, you could certainly choose, you know, an environmental issue to focus on. Global warming would be an interesting one to look at this through the lens of. But so after talking about sort of some of the future of what's going to happen if we don't make adjustments and what could happen, because you think that oil is causing problems, just think what happens if that happens with water. Because you can figure out alternatives to oil. Last I checked, we were a water-based species. There's no alternative to water. So, anyways, that's my presentation for today, but I can open it up to questions too.
You talked about the abundance of water. What might be happening, and you may not know this, but I'm thinking of, I drove across Dakotas. What's happening in North Dakota if they want a lot of water and there's not enough water coming down the Missouri system with the oil development, then you got the industry facing the resource issue. Is that something that's going to be different in every area then, or are you having some success with this kind of negotiation?
Yeah, I mean, we worked through some really difficult things. I'd say that the hardest people to work with was the Bureau of Reclamation. And the only reason they're really hard to work with is just because the engineers don't have great social skills. I mean, it's like they wanted to do stuff, but it took a while, and then they would make people mad, and they weren't really intending to, but they just, boy, they say the dumbest things sometimes, you know, and they think they're, but anyway. I hope there's no engineers in the room.
So human resources.
Well, that's an institution, you know, I look for people that I think I can get along with, have a conversation with that seem reasonable. There's people that on both sides of the aisle that I stay away from because I know that they're not going to be very helpful. So that's, I think, what depends on the locales. What's the social capital system look like? The human relationships. You see this in some communities figure problems everybody has, solid waste or whatever, they figure them out really quickly. I think the northern U.S. actually, as a rule, does a good job with this because the communities have a fabric that's pretty tight-knit, maybe because it's so dang cold in the winter, I don't know. but people have a community ethic, and there is sort of an open-mindedness about difference, you know. Or maybe everybody's Norwegian, so nobody's different, I don't know.
I suppose some businesses, when they use water, they use it, and it, say for agriculture, and then it kind of returns to, evaporates or returns to the soil, and it's okay. Then other businesses, maybe when they use water, they contaminate it.
Yes.
And then when it returns to the stream or the soil, it's in a contaminated state. Can you say something about how you deal with those sort of issues and what you've learned?
Well, contamination of water is, water quality is something that professionally I don't deal with because we really deal with flows. But some of the same principles apply. There's certainly, you don't want to get on the wrong side of the Clean Water Act, you know, from a perspective of a business, you know. But at the same time, working through a water pollution issue, I mean, that's one of the biggest problems is just we have this fresh water, but if it gets contaminated, then nobody can use it. You know, that's a really good example of, you know, one of the biggest threats right now. And it's why there are such stiff penalties for polluting the water, because, you know, you're messed, I mean, there's a lot of people that you just messed up things for if you make water undrinkable. You know, and it's totally resolvable. You know, there's things in place. But I think that it's really important for businesses like that to work hard to, I mean, be good neighbors in places they are. And if they're not, you know, the laws, I mean, there's, you know, it's the thing that can be complicated about it. And I think that one of the biggest threats I see in the work I do is that in some, when people really aren't held responsible for their actions. So a business goes bankrupt and, you know, it's just like maybe it gets diverted off into the taxpayer or something like that if there's a problem. But I think anytime you have a situation that, you know, maybe this is the socialist in me talking, but, you know, anytime you have a situation where an individual is not accountable for personal responsibility for their actions, they can parachute out. I think that's a problem because it doesn't make them responsible for the community around them. And I think it's important that people are. I have a friend who's, we love to talk about tax policy because he's this multimillionaire. He runs all these Papa Murphy's taking big pizza companies and stuff like that. But it's really interesting because he treats his employees very, very well. And he says, I do this because it helps me make more money. And I have a response. He has health care and scholarship programs and maternity leave for like taking big pizza employees. And he's like, yeah, this makes me money because I keep my people for a long time. It costs me a lot to train them. My managers are really happy. You know, I think that if companies had that ethic working in communities, you know, there's things that communities do for companies that really could save them a lot of money and heartache if there were good neighbors. You know, I don't know. It's tough though when people don't have to take responsibility.
Except there's a challenge in that too. Like Costco has that kind of reputation of really treating their employees well, and they get too much hassle from the stockholders who saying you're spending too much money on the employees. So they're kind of walking a very
your friend doesn't have stockholders.
He doesn't have stockholders, but he has a house in Bend and a house in a $1.5 million house in Sycadia.
He's got to keep all three wives happy. That's
where he's got an ex-wife, and I mean, you know, but he's making a bunch of money doing that, you know, this, because of, I'm not saying that. My point with that is that you have the value, okay, you want to make a bunch of money, great. I don't have any issue with that. Make as much money as you want to make, you know. But, like, you know, you still need to be responsible. And this is a tax debate I get into with. And it's like, you know, Don, I'm so glad you pay your taxes. Thank you for paying your taxes. I love driving on the roads and, you know. But it's, you know, it's again, I think it's fine. You just, people have their values, you know. He's probably my best friend, and you know, he's total libertarian, and, you know, we're different, but I think that the idea is, you think about your friends that are different than you, that the limiting, the factor is you respect each other's values, and you somehow respect them as a person. I think there's lots of room for that.
Maybe Costco needs to figure a way to educate their stockholders a little better.
The stockholders.
The long term benefits.
The stockholders are very, very distant, too. You know, I mean.
Yeah, the stockholders are looking for.
You're talking about this thought of human interaction, and I know we're time, too. So, this idea of human action, I think that the most. You want to change the world, okay? How you solve problems in this world. I think you start by walking out your door. Get out your door. Go to church. Talk to the person in the checkout line. Build a social capital, because they're going to start to get to know you as a person. You're going to start to get to know them as a person. You know, if we just spent time with each other, learning about each other, valuing each other, we have an amazing capacity as people to solve our problems, you know, and we can do that with a sense of community. I mean, I know I'm talking to the choir here because we're a whole village, but anyway. So I can answer questions if you guys want to go. It's fine too.
Thank you.